From the studios in KPCW Radio in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. If we can understand it, so can you. This is Scott Greenberg, and today on Cool Science Radio, we talk with Rob Dunn, professor of applied ecology at North Carolina State University and author of The Call of the Honey Guide, as he explains how there are thousands of mutualisms we have every day with nature. Next, we talk with Dr. Natalia Trajanova of Johns Hopkins University, who explains how AI can now identify patients at highest risk of sudden cardiac death more accurately than traditional cardiology tests.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
Many mutual relationships in nature are familiar to us, like our relationships with our pets. But others are naked to the human eye, like the yeasts in beer or the microbes in our digestive tracts. Our next guest, Dr. Rob Dunn, illuminates our partnerships with other species and explains how they hold the key to our biological future.
Dr. Dunn is a professor of applied ecology and author of the new book, The Call of the Honey Guide, What Science Tells Us About How to Live Well with the Rest of Life. He invites us to consider old and new partnerships that allow us to reconnect with nature. Rob Dunn, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
It's great to be on the show. Thank you so much.
So, Dr. Dunn, The Call of the Honey Guide. First, what is the honey guide?
So the honey guide's an amazing bird that lives across sub-Saharan Africa and has an unusual predilection. It loves wax from honeybees, and it has the problem that it has no way to get into honeybee hives. And so it loves a thing it can't get to. And so it's almost a mythological problem. How does it resolve this ancient want that it has no personal way of resolving? And what's occurred either independently tens of times or so far in the ancient past that it's just preserved in many different cultures is that the bird has figured out how to fly to human villages and to sing and fly a song and dance, a sort of choreographed bit that people have learned means, if you follow me, I will take you to a honeybee hive. And in each of the human cultures that the bird flies to, the humans respond in a specific way and then follow the honey guide to the hive. And the humans climb up and break into the hive and they get the honey and they leave for the honey guide the wax, or they give to the honey guide the wax. And in each of the places where this happens, it's deeply part of the human culture. Think about a time before humans had ways to get sweet things. That's when this relationship emerges. And so it's this very ancient and yet modern relationship in which a non-human species calls to humans, and it was our choice whether or not to respond. And so for me, that's the ethos of these relationships we have all around us every day, that species are calling to us and we're choosing to respond to some and not to others. And it begs of us the question, which species should we respond to? Who do we welcome into our lives?
Yeah, interesting. So you introduced this word mutualism that I hadn't really heard of before, but it almost sounds like, you know, with the honey guide, there is this symbiotic relationship that it's found its way along with humans to get to what it needs. What is mutualism in the way that you discuss in your book, The Call of the Honey Guide?
So when we think about mutualism in non-humans, and if you think about, for example, an ant that relies on a fungus that it farms, it's a kind of cooperation between two species in which both benefit. And typically they're in symbiosis, they're living together, but not always. And so it's just a mutually beneficial relationship. And for most of prehistory, for most of the history of the Earth, we would have measured that in terms of fitness. Does the ant reproduce more when it has the fungus? Does the fungus reproduce more when it has the ant? When we open it up to our relationships with nature today, the units that we would use to measure it become trickier. How do you judge whether your relationship with your dog is a mutualism? How do you judge whether your relationship with a chicken is a mutualism? And we really don't talk about that question very much. So, for example, if you think about dogs today, the total mass of dogs on Earth outweighs the mass of all wild mammals on Earth.
Wait, what?
So if you just put all the dogs in a pile, I don't recommend it, and you compared it to the pile of all wild mammals on Earth, the dogs outweigh all the other mammals combined.
Wow. Well, if you put my dog in there, then it really is going to tip the scale.
Yes, yeah, some of them tip more than others, right? And so it's the question then becomes, how do we measure these relationships? What units do we want to use? Which species do we want? And when you start to look at it, some relationships that we think are unimportant become very important, depending on what unit we measure. And then if you look across cultures, we partner with far more species than we think.
Well, when you think about it together, it's almost a question of who's training who. In the example of the honey guide, I almost feel like the bird is training humans to get what it wants. And it's a byproduct that the humans get what they want. Similar to, I think, your example in the book, you talk about how dogs have developed new facial muscles over generations to kind of either give us sad puppy face, I think was the quote in the book. And what does that do to us? How is our interaction with our pets, and specifically dogs, because this is Park City, we got to talk about our dogs. How does that relationship train humans? Or is it mutualism?
It's often both things at the same time. We are often tricking the other species. It's often tricking us at the same time that we're mutually benefiting. And so a group of scientists has shown in dogs that there's a new muscle that's evolved that actually pulls up their eyebrows, that makes them look like they're happier when they're looking at us, or more pleading, maybe is the way to say it. It's sad puppy face, but it's sort of, it doesn't have a great description, but you know it when you see it. When your dog looks up at you and raises its eyebrows and you think, oh, it loves me and feels deeply that it needs something and is baby-like in that moment. Those muscles are new in dogs, and they appear to have evolved in response to humans preferring dogs able to show us that baby-like, sad, happy face, whatever we call it. And what's even more amazing is the team of scientists that showed this went to pounds and was able to show that people prefer dogs in pounds that have more pronounced versions of those muscles. And so the dogs that have stronger muscles to make them look as though they're sad and pleading and childlike are more likely to get chosen, more likely to have their genes passed on. And so generation after generation, we're going to have more and more of these dogs that look as though they're expressing some emotion in that moment. But that muscular emotion is not tied to the corresponding neurological emotion. And so they look sad, but they feel whatever they were feeling before. And so evolution is tricking us in that moment. The dog is not consciously aware that it's tricking us, but that kind of thing happens all the time. It's very similar to what happens to us with beer and yeast. So if we think about a relationship with yeast that are used to make beer, wine, bread, if you look at the story of those yeast, you know, the standard way to tell it is that brewers figure out how to use the yeast from nature to grow them, to make bread leaven, to make wine, to make beer. But the other way to tell it is that yeast that are out in nature figure out how to convince humans to gather fruit, to put it in a pile so that it makes more yeast. And then eventually the humans can't find enough fruit. And so the yeast convince them to grow grain. And eventually the humans don't grow enough grain. So the yeast convince them to travel farther and grow ever more grain. And so you can tell the story of human agriculture, of human cities, of human colonialism, all from the perspective of the yeasts. Now, is that fully true? Certainly not, but neither is the standard story that we tell. And so there's a way in which these relationships are tricky and slippery that I find fun.
Well, it's bad enough that you've got me convinced that my dog is training me. Now you're telling my yeast is training me. Although we are talking about my most favorite things, beer, wine, bread, and dogs. But I want to stay on dogs for just one more moment. You say in the book that there's possibly a chemical message, a secret chemical message that dogs can detect by sniffing other dogs' butts and possibly even human crotches. So what's up with those secret messages?
Yeah. If your listeners tomorrow morning when they're walking around their neighborhood watch dogs, they will see them engaged in secret messaging. Dogs have special glands near their back end, anal sacs, that actually feed microbes, and those sacs evolve so as to emit odors. They're like little perfume sacs. You know, they're not placed in a perfumey area, but that's their function. And they're not well studied, but all the work that we've seen done on them suggests that they signal different things from one dog to another about the dog's condition, about whether it's male or female, about how closely related it is. And so the one part of the story that's interesting there is that this layer of communication dogs are doing that probably has all kinds of nuance we don't understand. But the other level is that we also have those glands, but they moved around in our body, and ours are in our armpits. And we also have some where they have them too. And we no longer pay attention to the smells of ours, at least consciously, but we know that our subconscious immune systems and olfactory systems are actually picking up on the smells of other humans. And we also know that dogs can smell those smells of other humans. And so it's entirely possible that when you're in that sort of complicated interaction with a dog in the morning, where you have your dog on its leash and somebody else has three poodles on their three leashes, and everybody's sniffing everybody, and you're just trying to walk a little bit farther away while remembering that funny story you were going to tell in that moment but can't quite get to, that those other dogs have assessed you fully and know how well or not well you are and what's going on with you in a way that you yourself don't know.
This is cool science, Rob. It really is. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dr. Rob Dunn. He's a professor of applied ecology and the author of a new book, The Call of the Honey Guide, What Science Tells Us About How to Live Well with the Rest of Your Life. Okay, Rob, you are at North Carolina State. You're in the Department of Applied Ecology. What is that? What is applied ecology? That's sort of a new twist, but I mean, it sounds like everything you're talking about, really.
Yeah, so ecology as a field is the study of the general rules of life, and often ecological rules, sometimes evolutionary rules. And then applied ecology is thinking about how do you bring those into our daily life to make them useful to humans. And so often that's thinking about what do we know about the population biology of salmon that helps us produce more salmon. Sometimes it's thinking about how is climate change affecting corn so we can think about the future of corn. And then you have unusual folks like me who think about humans and microbes and bodies, but nonetheless thinking about what are the rules we know about life that are germane to thinking about our own daily workings.
Oh, very cool. All right. Well, let's move into a little bit, because we love to talk technology on this show as well. You talk about how we can possibly and should be using technology to help us create or be more aware of these mutualisms within our biological world. And it makes me think about the kinds of relationships that we're able to grow more aptly when we have an app which helps us, say, identify bird sounds. Mm-hmm. That brings us closer to birds, but I'm not sure if that's what you're talking about when you mention, you know, we should use technology to help us be more symbiotic. Can you provide an insight there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the bird app is an amazing example. I mean, take Merlin, for example, which is a bird app that you can put in your phone. You turn on Merlin, and it will help you to know which birds you're hearing in your yard. And it aids your senses, and that quickly you'll find there are birds in your yard that you didn't know were there that are calling. And once you hear them, and it tells you what you're hearing, the world enriches by an extra bird. But imagine an extra layer of that, where when you went outdoors, you also knew which of those species, which of those landscapes was benefiting you. And think now about when you're, you know, if you've got an Apple Watch or whatever kind of watch on, and it's rewarding you for taking some steps and chiding you when you don't take steps. Well, what if it's also rewarding you for walking into the kind of nature that it knows benefits you, and for walking away from the kind of nature of landscapes that might threaten you in some way? And so what if our devices could steer us towards, even just in where we walk, more beneficial relationships? But you might also imagine in your house, most of the choices we make about other species are via our current senses. But in the average house, there are 100,000 species. Most of those we don't perceive in any real way. Maybe we smell them sometimes. But what if your device could help you to figure out which of those invisible species are the ones that really benefit you and help to reward you for engendering more of those? That we have this whole set of relationships that are important to us, but we have no way of reinforcing good behaviors toward those relationships or lightly penalizing bad behaviors. Or you could even think about, you know, if the tree in my yard is benefiting you know, my family, but also a next generation, because of how much carbon it's pulling out of the atmosphere and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Well, that's a huge benefit. What if walking by that tree makes me sort of tingly with delight via some device every time I walk by it? None of this is to say any of those are the particular devices that we want, but what's it look like to ask these questions? What's it look like to reimagine these relationships? I think it's a fun kind of question to provoke engineers with and to get people thinking about. I wonder, you know, Lynn and Scott, do you have devices? What are there species you would like to hear and talk to and interact with that you don't already?
I think that I get a lot of joy in particular environments. You know, so for example, and being somewhat selfish, when I'm out on the river fly fishing, for example, my happiest day is when I don't catch anything because I'm just out there enjoying everything around me. I do get that tingling even without my Apple Watch telling me that this is a good place for me to be. So I completely understand that these local ecosystems can be very beneficial for each of us on an individual basis. My question would be maybe going a little broader with global ecosystems under threat. How do you view human-caused disruptions, maybe like monoculture or habitat loss? How do you think these undermine our mutualistic relationships and what gives us joy on a more global basis?
I'll go to the fly fishing first and come back to the global and just say, I mean, I think the fly fishing is an amazing example because that pleasure of being out there fly fishing, you know, that's exactly the kind of thing we want people, that I would hope people feel rewarded by. But it's pretty quiet relative to the loudness of people's computers and phones. And so how do we, you know, are there ways to adjust the volume even temporarily to get more people out to that fly fishing moment or whatever their version is? But when we scan back out, Scott, to ask that bigger question, what's it look like when we think about these global relationships? You know, on the one hand, humans now are in mutualistic relationships with more species than they ever have been, almost certainly, our collective. And so our collective relationships are just extraordinary. And so if you went to place from place to place around Earth, the number of plants we bring into our gardens that we grow somewhere, the number of animal species that we're in relationships with, it's just mind-numbingly diverse. But on the other hand, if you measure it in terms of calories, if you measure it in terms of land area, we depend disproportionately on a tiny handful of kinds of mutualisms. And so I think we should constantly be asking questions about, is that distribution right? How many should we depend on? And what does this small number, what kinds of risks does it pose? What kind of future does it foreclose upon? And so in terms of kinds of risks, when we depend on very, very few kinds of crop species and very few cultivars of each of those species, our collective risk of the loss of one of those crops is extraordinary. And so if you think about chocolate or bananas, both have huge risks right now from pathogens that we're just sort of barely holding back and hoping we clumsily dance around long enough. And so how should we be thinking about that? On the other hand, if we just look at the kinds of things we're in relationships with, the types of crops that are growing fastest are ones we use for sugar or oil. Mm. And so I think there's an argument to be made that our biggest mutualisms today are really framed in a very simple way by a sort of corporate ability to hotwire our taste receptors to the land. And so if you said, well, if we pleased our taste receptors, what landscape would we make? It's the one we've made. It's really sweet. It's really fatty. Those things are both really cheap and often at the expense of more biologically diverse landscapes, often at the expense of more nutritious partners. But I think that the trick with that global comparison is that very rarely are we individually presented with the choice, what should we do globally? Far more often we're presented with some more local choice. And so I think, you know, it's important to be aware of that global scenario and for policymakers to have the best evidence possible to think about alternate futures. But for us as individuals, where we typically have the most ability to make change is local or in that middle sort of level.
Yes, that's really interesting. Rob, as you were talking, it made me think of, yeah, it's hard to sort of make a corporate structure around something like kale. But then, you know, when you're talking about how there's been this, you know, this massive, movement towards trying to monetize things that are sweet, And yet, I've been thinking since, you know, during this conversation about bees, about honeybees outside. And honey, for example, is something that is sweet, that we do love, that we, that our taste receptors and sensors are focused on, you know, something we like. How can we move towards things that are appealing to those taste receptors and sensors?
Maybe two parts of the answer. One is there's a scientist in Denmark, Ulla Mortensen, and he's really been, he works on flavor. He's a physicist that got interested in flavor, turned out to be a way more fun life. And his life work has been dedicated to trying to figure out how we make nutritious, sustainable foods delicious. And so he works on trying to use flavor to sort of rework what our food landscapes look like. And so I'd point folks to his work. It's an amazing example of a part of that. And Lynn, the other part of that question that I can maybe pull out there is that we can also think about mutualistic relationships with humans that also have other indirect effects in other species, or that are sort of win-win. Mm-hmm. And so if we think about relationships with crops that also benefit pollinators, that also benefit other species. And so if we think about traditional planting of squash, there's a squash bee that when Native Americans moved squash north into North America, the squash bee moved with the squash. And it's this amazing sort of chubby bee that perfectly fits the squash flower and falls asleep sometimes while pollinating. And it's delightful. And so that's a case where planting squash in its native landscape in slightly more traditional ways, where the bee still has the ability to hang on, helps the bee. It helps the species that also depend on the bee. And so we can look for those kinds of relationships that have these secondary benefits, which I think is really an important piece of the whole. But I think we also have to be conscious that we're on a finite planet. And so, you know, any choice we're making is always disadvantaging some species. And so when you're planting a tree, you're disadvantaging a grassland, right? And so I think looking for better synergies while being aware of the finite planet is the way I would move.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you say that. You know, we're always encouraged in our diets to eat a variety of things. And it really makes a lot of sense in the context of this conversation. And then, you know, I was recently speaking with an herbalist who was talking about how there are 80,000 medicinal plants on this planet. And, you know, again, going to your nine crops or whatever it is, nine main crops, that we really should, to engage not only in our own health, but in the ecology of the planet, we should diversify, right? We should look at more crops. We shouldn't do you know, a meat-only diet, for example, which is kind of a trend that someone has been talking to me about recently, that's, yo, we should only have meat. It's like, with 80,000 plants out there? Really? So, interesting.
I think the other connection point there would be that, you know, as we think about measuring these relationships, we can think about our current generation, but we can also telescope into the future. And if we telescope into the future, we then think not only about what we depend on now, but what we might depend on in the future. And I'll give the quick four example that Veronica Sinote at the University of Copenhagen and Sevki Mutlu at Rachel Carson Center in Munich and others recently discovered that the only place so far that the key bacteria in sourdough bread has been found in nature is in the mouths of certain ants. And so part of that story seems to suggest that that's how it first comes into human use, is from the ants. And that in some Turkish populations, people use the ants to make yogurt. Maybe it moves from the yogurt to the sourdough bread. At its surface level, that's esoteric. But the other thing it reveals is that if we don't want any other lactic acid bacteria with similar uses, we're likely to benefit from going to look at related ants. Well, we're not going to get there this year, but if we do that at some time ever, those ants need to still be there.
Yeah.
And so there's this potential value of species all around us. And And that potential value simply depends on our descendants being slightly more creative and smarter than us. And if we prestige that value, suddenly it opens up the role of the wild forest and the wild grassland and the stinking swamp to being far more important than we typically think of them as being. And that for me is tricky philosophically. How far into the future do you go? How smart do you think our descendants are? And yet in our daily lives, we give it no priority. And so even lifting it up a little bit changes the math, I think.
Yeah. Wow. This is such an interesting kind of illuminating and eye-opening conversation, at least for me. The book is The Call of the Honey Guide, What Science Tells Us About How to Live Well with the Rest of Life. Our guest is Dr. Rob Dunn. Rob, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you so much.
Lynn and Scott, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
Artificial intelligence, or AI, is transforming every corner of our lives, but few areas are seeing its life-saving potential, quite like healthcare. This morning, we explore one groundbreaking application using artificial intelligence to predict and help prevent sudden cardiac death. Incredibly, AI can now identify patients at highest risk more accurately than doctors can.
And joining us is one of the pioneers behind this innovation, Dr. Natalia Trajanova, a renowned professor at Johns Hopkins University with joint appointments in biomedical engineering and medicine. She leads the Alliance for Cardiovascular Diagnostic and Treatment Innovation, where she brings together scientists and clinicians to reshape how we diagnose and treat heart disease.
She also heads the Computational Cardiology Lab and is a key member of the Institute for Computational Medicine and made history as the first woman to hold an endowed professorship at the Whiting School of Engineering. Dr. Trajanova, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. Really a pleasure.
You know, we all know how important AI is and how scary and how, oh, you could apply so many adjectives to AI. But I think it's really important for us to be aware of the scientific innovation and advancement surrounding this. Now, you say that doctors haven't been able to really accurately predict who is going to drop dead from cardiac arrest. To us about, you know, why that is that doctors can't always predict that, but AI is going to be able to.
It is a sudden event, sudden cardiac death, cardiac arrest. And very often there are no warning signs that can signal what is going to happen. Also, even for patients who are seen in the hospital and are known to have heart disease, really the clinical guidelines cannot encompass all the amount of data that is collected for these patients and extract patterns that might be predictable of impending cardiac arrest. So prediction currently in the clinic, I'll take a step back and say what we want to do is we want to figure out which patients are at high risk for sudden cardiac death so we can prevent that from happening. And if a patient is already has seen a doctor for certain cardiac condition, the way this is done is by implanting a defibrillator. You guys are aware of that. Mm-hmm. The defibrillator will shock the heart back into rhythm and prevent sudden cardiac death from happening. So you want to know which patients need to have defibrillators implanted and which not. But deploying a device like a defibrillator is not a simple task for the patient. It's actually a lifelong commitment in a way. It is changes the way a patient lives, lifestyle, activities that can be done. It has also numerous side effects associated with malfunctions of the components, and it's really, really painful to have a shock. So particular for diseases that occur in younger patients, having to deploy a device like that, you really have to think very hard whether this patient really should have a device. Currently, for every 20 defibrillators implanted, only one patient derives benefit. The other 19 do not. They just get defibrillators implanted and they do not, but have to experience the side effects. So generally, prediction how to who of the patients will benefit from a preventive implantation of defibrillator is not an easy task, and it's very inaccurate. For some diseases, like infarct, if a patient gets an infarct, then there is a clinical guideline, still not accurate, but at least there is a quite wide used clinical guideline, which is ejection fraction of the heart less than 35%. Ejection fraction is the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart with every beat. And if this is less than 35%, then it's considered that this patient is at high risk. But that's only for patients that are post-infarct. For other cardiac diseases, it's very difficult. And what we deal in this research is the most common inherited cardiac disease called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. In this disease, the heart thickens and also fibrosis, kind of scarring, grows in it, and it creates like conditions for the electrical activity, which is the normal heartbeat, to get attached to places and result in arrhythmia, which leads to sudden cardiac death. So it's particularly, this disease is particularly hard to predict who's at risk for sudden cardiac death. There is no, well, I mean, there are clinical guidelines, American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology have clinical guidelines. European Society for Cardiology has a guideline. There is also a risk calculator. But despite that, the accuracy is very, very low. And it's particularly troubling because this is a disease of the younger population.
Yes.
This is a younger population.
Yeah. So let me ask you a little bit more about this because I hadn't heard of HCM before, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And as you said before, you just mentioned that it is a genetic, it's something that you
inherited. Yeah.
So in many cases, these are the young people that are just having these heart attacks, cardiac arrest, not having known at all before, like they have no lifestyle, no other predictors. And many young people, you know, unlike some of the rest of us in different decades of our lives, you know, we have gone in to maybe have a cardiac, a calcium cardiac test, or we sort of know about our hearts. So this is really going to be something that saves young people especially. Can you tell us a little bit more about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy?
Yeah, it is exactly an inherited heart disease. And as I mentioned, the disease leads to thickening of the wall, of the cardiac wall. And it thickens, particularly the left ventricle, the left chamber, which is the main pump in our body. It thickens, and so you can understand now the contraction occurs with much bigger. You have to work against a much thicker muscle. And in addition to that, as I said, the scarring develops within the tissue. This is called fibrosis. Typically, fibrosis actually occurs in older hearts. When we grow older, we naturally develop that. But in these hearts, because the contraction is so difficult, they grow scarring from the very high pressures that are developed in the cardiac tissue. And so they develop these sort of hallmarks of impending arrhythmias. We know mechanistically, because we studied the arrhythmias, that these can be sort of seeds or substrates for arrhythmias. And so these patients develop that in their younger age. And so that is a prerequisite of potential arrhythmias or sudden cardiac arrest events.
Dr. Trajanova, just out of curiosity, is there an estimate about how many people in the general population are diagnosed with HCM or walking with HCM?
Yeah, so hypertrophic cardiomyopathy affects one in every 200 to 500 individuals worldwide. And in the young population is the primary reason for sudden cardiac death.
But what inspired you to use AI to identify patients with HCM who were at risk of sudden cardiac arrest or sudden cardiac death?
So first, we're interested very much in cardiac disease, cardiac arrhythmias, and arrhythmias little arrhythmias, we are particularly interested, sudden cardiac death. We are particularly interested because it's really the biggest, is the leading cause of mortality and a major public health worldwide. So this is our biggest interest. And from there, we have looked previously in our research in post-infarct patients and predicting who is at high risk, also using AI. And then we went towards something that is also quite widespread, which is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and particularly the fact that it affects the younger population in the prime of their life. So this was our motivation. But we are generally very much interested in arrhythmias, sudden cardiac death, AI. We're interested in personalized treatment of patients with arrhythmias. This is our general area of research.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Natalia Trajanova. She is a researcher at Johns Hopkins University, and she's talking to us about how artificial intelligence, it's a new innovation to help identify these people who are at risk of potential sudden cardiac arrest and death. Currently, the way, or previously, I should say, the way that doctors would identify this arrhythmia and maybe the need to, as they believe, put in a defibrillator is that only works in one out of 20 people to any extent, as you say, is to identify just all kinds of arrhythmias. And then, as you said before, it's a certain percentage of arrhythmia. And okay, this identifies you as a patient who needs a defibrillator. So how is AI specifically working to identify who may, you know, who really needs a defibrillator?
Okay, so first of all, the way doctors identify who is at high risk, if they have an arrhythmia, they already have an arrhythmia. Typically, this is for patients who do not yet have and are likely to develop. And so the way they decide when patient is likely to develop an arrhythmia is they follow a guidelines that are developed by the various societies. So American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, they had a combined working group that clarified what are the guidelines, and these guidelines are used across clinical practice everywhere in the US. So the guideline says, does the patient have this? Does it have this? There are all kinds of clinical measurements, everything like electronic health records. They take variables from there, put it in a calculator and say, okay, this patient looks like we'll have a high risk. That's how it's done in the clinic. It's done by guidelines. So what we did is we created this AI risk predictor to substitute the guidelines. So in a way, it is something that we want to be unified across. Anybody can use it. Any doctor can use it instead of using the guidelines, because we demonstrated, and this is the important thing, we didn't just develop a AI algorithm to predict risk of sudden cardiac death. We compared it with the clinical guidelines on the same patient, and we demonstrated how inaccurate or how the accuracy is so small. It's like almost a random chance in these patients. And we showed that with our graphs. While our prediction, we have like a 90%, up to 90% certainty that this patient will have a high risk of sudden cardiac death. So that's the big difference here.
I'm just curious, how does your AI model actually work? And what kind of data are you using to make these predictions?
Yes, it's a pretty sophisticated, and that's why it got such a, you know, in a top level publication, because it's quite advanced. So what we do is, it's a multimodal AI. What that means is it takes a different data modalities. It takes electronic health records, whatever is available for the patient. It takes electronic health records. Also, it takes records from radiology. If the patient has echo, if the patient has gone through an MRI imaging, the radiologist have recorded. So it's their recordings, the radiology recordings. So electronic health records, radiology recordings, assessment. And then the third input channel is the actual MRI scans, but a specific type of MRI scan, which is called contrast enhanced. And why we are using contrast enhanced is because this is the only modality, imaging modality, that shows the scarring, this fibrosis that I talked to you about. And this is a completely underused. Nobody uses that. And so maybe the, in the radiology report, there will be, all patient has 20% of fibrosis or scarring. We take the whole raw image. So in other words, the AI doesn't look how much fibrosis there is as a like percent, but it looks at the entire distribution and in three-dimensional object and the distribution of the change in signal intensity in the image. So it has this very high-dimensional information about how the damage is occurring in the heart. This, a normal doctor or radiologist, we, with our eyes, we cannot see that. We cannot make sense of that multidimensional data. So that's the third channel, and this is a very big innovation in our multimodal AI predictor. In addition to just reports from radiology and electronic health records, we have this particularly interesting channel of data input that utilizes this very rich multidimensional data about the sort of a structural remodeling damage to the heart of the patient. All this information from these three different channels is combined, and we use sophisticated deep learning. We use transformers, visual transformer, and we have a fusion module at the end that synthesizes all the information that comes from the three different channels and gives us a score, whether it's a high risk or low risk for the patient. So that's how it works. So the key is to have all kinds of data and also to have this very sophisticated channel and very high dimensional data that goes into the risk predictor. We looked into, when you say it is a multimodal, having different modalities, then you have to demonstrate that the multimodal prediction is better than any of the single modalities. So we compare the prediction of the multimodal AI predictor versus any, if you use only electronic health records, so only the radiology report or only the contrast enhanced MRI. And the combination of the three gave us the highest score. So it is a true multimodal AI predictor.
Wow, Dr. Trajanova, this feels like a major breakthrough in cardiology. Out of curiosity, how do you personally envision this AI tool being used in clinical practice?
Oh, we are going to try to implement it here at Hopkins. You know, I'm talking with my collaborators here. We would like to have it the way we envision it. Once it is trained, the algorithm takes less than 30 seconds to calculate. So it's really, really quick. So we want to connect it to the electronic health records, and you're able to say, oh, calculate risk, like have a button that says calculate risk. And then it uses the scans and all the other information and basically calculates that. We want to connect that to the electronic health record. So when a patient comes in for assessment, this can be, you know, a tool for the clinician to make their clinical decision ultimately.
Mm-hmm. And so this leads into the next whole question about treatment. I mean, if we know and we've identified with the help of AI and all this incredible work that you've been doing and all this innovation to identify someone at risk, what can we then do to help them, even if they do have sudden cardiac arrest, to survive? Is it all about the defibrillator, or is it about something else we can do?
So there are a number of things. First is, yes, we can make, somebody is really at a high risk, then yes, decision can be made to implant the defibrillator. Another way to approach that is, we also work in the area of predicting personalized treatment for arrhythmias. In some patients, it could be possible, like there is a procedure called ablation, in which you thread a catheter in the heart and you can burn or freeze or deliver other type of energy to basically kill a piece of the tissue that is the perpetrator. So assessment can be made in this patient whether the arrhythmias involve some particular piece of tissue that is really prone to generating the arrhythmias, and decision can be made to preemptively ablate that portion. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we stave off, you know, the impending arrhythmias and then follow the patient, because after many years, it probably will remodel and more fibrosis will develop. It needs to be reassessed and see whether we can do that again or maybe implant, even as a intermediate therapy, because if you want to implant a defibrillator, it's better to have it in later life and so forth. So it can be made this multi-tiered decision for treatment, when to do this, when to do that. In addition to that, in our paper, at the end of the paper, in the supplementary material, we have included what we call interpretability analysis. And you can see for every single patient, what was the variable or set of variables that brought the risk to be high? What is the most important negative, or what was the variable that, despite other bad things, brought the patient on the side of not having an arrhythmias? And some of these might be variables that are amenable to life changes. So that is another thing. Having interpretable algorithm is very important because, number one, you can explain to the patient, oh, here are the things that make you high risk. You know, the patient has more agency in understanding and in decision-making. And also, it is really important for the clinician to understand why did the algorithm exactly predict that. And so understanding what combination of the parameters lead to that. We also attempted to show with interpretability analysis what specific part in the scarring of the heart was really important for making that decision. And that might be a part that would be particularly important should an ablation be decided upon, take into account.
So you're a renowned researcher in biomedical engineering, and you're at Johns Hopkins, which, you know, most people know is just one of the leading institutions for this kind of research. This work, this innovation, has been federally funded. And I'm assuming that you don't sit and write grant applications and things like that because you're researching the actual, creating these incredible algorithms. But what does this mean, you know, with the new cuts to funding for scientific research? What does it mean for this kind of important work?
I mean, I honestly live in constant fear. I am not joking. I have a very large research team. You know, I have grants in that will be reviewed. I have current grants, and just, you know, having funding, I don't mind writing grants. I actually like writing grants. We strategize for research and so forth. And I find, you know, once a grant is funded, it gives you like this ability to work through a problem and so forth. And without that, I just have to close shop, seriously. I mean, it's been NIH funding for us. It is everything that we do has been NIH funded. I have like 10 PhD students. I have many other researchers. Everybody is funded by NIH. All this research that we do, both in prediction and prognostication, and also how to devise the best treatment, it's impossible without the federally funded research. So I don't know how to put it in any other way. This is a life existential question for us.
Dr. Troyanova, I just have a follow-up question about the funding. I'm assuming that you weren't born here in the United States, but you came here because maybe this was the center of scientific innovation, but no doubt you're still tuned in globally. Where do you think the center of scientific innovation is going to be if we decide to continue slashing federal funding for this work?
Yes, I was born in Bulgaria, and I came here. I came to Duke University. Yeah, I have an accent, so you know I'm not born here.
Just a little one.
A little bit,
a cute one.
Yes, yeah. So yes, to me, there was no, like, there was no question that that is the mecca of science. And I would have never gone anywhere else for, I mean, this is, it was just an amazing, I have had an amazing journey here in the US. In my field currently, a lot of the research seems shifting. I mean, Europe has always been really good in cardiology and particularly cardiac electrophysiology. But now there is the comparison. I'm talking comparison now. The European Union has put a lot of money into funding projects across countries in this area. And they have a lot of, I just see on LinkedIn or on Twitter, a lot of people are working. We were the pioneers, particularly in computational cardiology. And also in AI, we are doing a lot of innovation. But, oh my God, so many people have sort of, they haven't caught up with us, but they are really, because the funding in Europe has been so strong, have really come very fairly close to what we are doing. At some point, it's, you know, funding dictates who overtakes who.
Dr. Trajanova is a professor at Johns Hopkins University with joint appointments in biomedical engineering and medicine. Wow, what a career you've had. And congratulations on this most recent discovery.
Thank you so very much. It's such a pleasure. I think this is a great radio station to promote cool science. I really love that you guys had me here. Much appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. You can find this episode, as well as past episodes, on the KPCW website or on the new KPCW app.
And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.
If you have a suggestion for a guest or topic for a future episode, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.